I'm going to start out talking about the objectives of the macroinvertebrate and parafighting program, and then we'll go into the methodology and the QAQC. I'll give you a quick overview of the results that are presented in the environmental baseline document and give you a quick summary of the key points that I wanted you to take home from the talk. The objective of the program is pretty simple, basically to characterize the existing macroinvertebrate populations out at the project site at key locations and also the periphyton diatom community and chlorophyll A milligrams per liter per site. The question that I always get when I give this presentation is, what is a benthic macroinvertebrate? So I always like to start out by giving a brief description of what those are. Substrate-dwelling organisms that lack a backbone and are visible to the naked eye. Now, why do we study those? Basically, it's because they're sensitive to water quality and habitat change. And if anybody is looking for some light reading to take home, I also have a few references listed here that you can feel free to study up on that describe the theory as to how these are used to assess habitat and water quality change in aquatic systems. I did want to point out that we talk a lot about the differences between dipterans and the conglomerate of the EPT taxa. Diptera is an order in the macroinvertebrate realm that are known as fairly tolerant. Those taxa are fairly tolerant of changes in water quality and habitat. EPT stands for Ephemeroptera, Plecoptera, and Trichoptera, and those are also shown up here in pictures. The first one is the mayfly, which is also the Ephemeroptera. The second picture is the caddisfly, which is the Trichoptera. And the third picture at the bottom is the stonefly, which is the Plecoptera. Now, do we have any fly fishermen in the room? No fly fishermen. Okay, great. if you are a fly fisherman or have spouses that are fly fishermen or women, you may notice that some of these pictures look very similar to the flies that folks use when they're fishing. Obviously, these are high quality fish food, and that is another reason that we study them. Periphyton is defined as algae that is attached to aquatic substrates. They are an important indicator of water quality, and they're responsive also to water quality and habitat changes. We study diatoms and chlorophyll A, that portion of the periphyton communities for this project. In 2004, we started out with benthic sampling using the Alaska Stream Condition Index. Those are based on rapid bioassessment protocols developed by the EPA. We also did drift sampling in 2004. I'll show you some results of those studies later on, but basically in 2005, we decided to drop the drift sampling and to add the Cerber sampling to our methodology, which is another benthic technique. In 2004, we started out looking at periphyton using diatoms and identifying diatoms as our periphyton program. Then we added the ADFNG's methodologies that they used at Red Dog for chlorophyll A analysis in 2005. I won't belabor this map very much because I know after 3 days of seeing the project area, you're probably fairly familiar with it by now. I did want to point out that the general deposit area is shown here in yellow. And all of these sites were sampled at some point in our program between 2004 and 2007, but not all of those sites were sampled every year. The ones that were sampled every year were NK100A, NK100C, SK100B, UT100D, and UT100B, which is somewhere around here. Along the road, the proposed road corridor in the Bristol Bay drainage, we did have three sites. We had URSA 100B, Baraden Creek, and Red Creek. And in the Cook Inlet area, we did have two sites, one further north named Unnamed Creek. That was only sampled once in June of 2004. and Y Valley Creek further south of there, which was also co-located with the fish program sampling site. And that was sampled twice, once in June and once in August. I should also mention that in 2004, we did start out by sampling twice, once in June and once in August. In 2005 and beyond, we went to sampling only in June because we felt it wasn't necessary to sample multiple times during the summer. So getting into this methodology just a little bit, the Alaska Stream Condition Index was developed by Elaine Major and Mike Barber in 2001. It's a little bit different than the server sampling that you'll see here about in just a moment. Basically what it is, if you can imagine, you walk up to a stream site, you establish a 100 meter stream reach, and within that 100 meter stream reach, you will be able to pinpoint several different macroinvertebrate types of habitat. For example, cobble, undercut bank, large woody debris, pool habitats. Those are the types of different macroinvertebrate habitats that we're looking for. Within that 100 meter stream reach, you will then figure out the proportion of habitat that is represented in that stream reach. So for example, if 50% of your habitat type is cobble, you would take 10 of your samples from the cobble habitat. If 10% of your habitats was classified as pool habitat, you would take 2 of your 20 samples from that type of habitat. You take all of the material, combine it together, and that makes one sample for that site. That's a little bit different than the server sampling, because with the servers, you're going in, you're targeting only one cobble habitat in that stream reach, but you're getting 5 distinct benthic samples from those cobble habitats. And you identify them, you sort them, and you identify them separately so that in the end, you can combine those data for better descriptive statistics purposes. But again, with servers, you're losing a little bit of the resolution of what you would find in some of the other habitats as well. And then the drift net's fairly simple. We would stretch 5 drift nets across the stream and get a flow in front of each one. And then based on what we found in each net, we would correlate that with the flow and try to figure out which invertebrates were drifting and a little bit of a numerical calculation for each one. Laboratory methods for invertebrates. We did sort our samples and identify them to genus when possible. Sometimes there were missing appendages that wouldn't allow us to go further far enough down to identify to genus. And we did have a 10% QAQC program where folks would look over what the other scientists were doing and for 10% of those samples and make sure that we were getting all of the invertebrates out of those samples. And we also prepared a reference collection for third-party QC for every year of this program. ASCII samples were subsampled to a 300 count. They almost always had more than 300, so we would spread the material on this tray in the picture and take one square and pick the invertebrates out until we got to 300 or just over 300. Almost all of the CIRMER material was sorted and identified. The only case in which all of the material was not sorted is if we had several thousand invertebrates in one server sample, which was not often. For diatoms, we used the RAPA bioassessment protocols that were developed in 2004. We sampled in all habitats and composited 20 samples for those diatom analyses. For chlorophyll A, we would go into, again, that one cobble area and take 10 cobbles and take a 5-centimeter square sampling area out of each, off the top of each cobble, and then take that material, run it through a 0.45 micron filter, extract the water, add magnesium carbonate, take the filter and put it in a bag with desiccant and freeze it, and then submit it to the laboratory. Just a little bit about the paraffite and laboratory methods. Those diatom samples were acid digested by HDR scientists, and then they were sent to Michigan State University's Algal Ecology Laboratory for identification by Scott Rollins. The chlorophyll A samples were examined by Bill Morris with ADF&G up in Fairbanks, who many of you probably know. And just a nice little graphic through our microscope shot of the diatoms that we were seeing in the project area. So I'm going to talk a little bit here about the results. I want to encourage everybody to take a look at the EBD itself, because I'm just giving you a quick overview of the types of information that we are presenting in the EBD. There's way more analysis that you can find in the report itself. So here we have June versus August 2004 taxa richness. We have June on the top graph, and we have August on the bottom graph. And then you can see we have ASCII and drift samples presented on here. ASCII is the darker column. Drift is the lighter column, and the sites are along the x-axis. Along the y-axis is the number of taxa. So along with the revelation that there are quite a few taxa out at the project site, we're getting up to 30 in some cases, that's fairly diverse. The other point that I wanted to make is that in most cases, ASCII collected more taxa than the drift samples did. And that's part of the reason that we decided to drop the drift program after that year. Now we have, in 2005, I mentioned that we added the Cerber sampling. Now we have ASCII and Cerber presented from 2005 and 2007, again for the taxa richness metric. 2005 is on the top graph, and 2007 is on the bottom graph. Cerber is in the dark, ASCII is in the light. And you can see here that Cerbers generally collected more taxa than the ASCIIs did, which we thought was fairly interesting. And this is in the mine site area. You'll see something a little bit different when we get to the road site area. But I thought that was fairly interesting because, as you remember, ASCII is the sampling methodology that pulls from more of the habitats. So we expected to see a little bit more in ASCII than we did in Cerbers. Here we have a representation of the taxa composition for the sites that were collected as part of the Cerber methodology. We have our sites along the x-axis. Along the y-axis, we have the percent taxa composition. And what I wanted to point out here is that the sites are fairly well dominated by Diptera, by the Diptera taxa. And that's common in Alaska. We see that in invertebrate studies in Alaska quite often. If you were in the lower 48, probably not quite as common. Again, these are mine site results, proposed mine site results. Quick slide on the diatom taxa richness. We did identify close to 20 taxa. Diatoms were identified down to species, so these are up to 20 species that we identify for the diatoms in the project area. And here we have the chlorophyll A concentrations from 2005 and 2007 out at the project site, and we have sites along the x-axis. Along the y-axis, we have chlorophyll A in milligrams per meter square. And we have in the bars, we have 2005 chlorophyll A, that's the dark bar, and 2007 chlorophyll A, that is the light bar. And the point here is that chlorophyll typically is higher in 2005, but interesting little spike here at UT100D in 2007. Still not quite sure why that's happening, but again, that's upstream. If you remember the map, that's upstream of the project area, so it's kind of fairly interesting. A little bit of results overview for the macrovertebrate taxa richness in the rogue corridor. This is a little bit different than what we just saw in the proposed mine site area. If you notice here, ASCII is in the lighter bar, Cerber is in the darker bar, and we have our Bristol Bay road sites along the x-axis, the number of taxa along the y-axis. Now here, ASCII samples seem to dominate the taxa richness, which is completely opposite of what we saw before. I have a personal theory about that, I do remember being out at Red Creek, which I believe is aptly named because it's got a lot of reds in it, but we'll hear more about that later. but that creek, I remember visually that you actually had to watch where you stepped because the salmon were just lined up, chock full in that creek, ready to go upstream, and just chock full of marine derived nutrients. So when the salmon die, there's more marine derived nutrients. So perhaps that's driving the primary productivity at those sites. In the proposed mine site area, the results that we saw before, of course, you do still get marine derived nutrients coming up those systems, but it's further up the system. And then here we have the taxa composition for those same road sites, and again, different than what we saw before. These are not primarily driven by Diptera, which are represented in the light columns here. They are more driven by the EPT taxa, which we said are more sensitive. Road corridor site chlorophyll A concentrations are very similar to what we saw in the proposed mine site area, and are also very similar to what we're seeing in other projects in Alaska. And then just want to give you a quick overview of some take-home points from this study. There is quite a bit of a diverse population of invertebrates out at the project site. The preferred methodologies appear to be cerbers over ASCIIs and drifts. And for periphyton, that would probably be chlorophyll A. The results are variable by year, probably based on weather, temperature, nutrient flow. And when you're looking at these data, you consider them with the fish information, with the water quality information, as a whole system diagnostic check. So they fit into the entire system of the aquatic food chain. And that's how that's their power in using them for monitoring. Any questions?
Maybe you could talk, Andrew, a little bit more about the monitoring aspect. Like once a project gets going and there's a mine operating, the macroinvertebrates are a very, very good tool to sample them outside of the direct operation and downstream of it to determine the health. And that's a really important, actually, it's an important part of all of our baseline studies. They all have that function of establishing the baseline, and then once we're operating, monitoring the environment to look for changes.
Do you have an answer to that, or okay. Do you want
to? Bob Seale, USGS. Have you done anything to look at the geochemistry of the invertebrates to see what sort of metal loads they may carry?
We have not done that, Bob.
Phil North, Environmental Protection Agency. I'm wondering a couple things, and I guess I'll just lay them out, and then you can answer them as you want. I'm wondering, are you thinking of dropping the ASCII in favor of the server? That's question number one. And then number two is, I'm assuming it, in the ASCII process, you're documenting the various habitats that you're sampling, and I'm wondering if that's useful data in itself as time goes on and things might change. There might be an opportunity to go in and resample those same habitat types or even see if they're there. And that might be kind of a useful long-term monitoring element. So I guess that's all I had.
I had a hard time hearing the first part of your question, but I believe you're asking what led to the determination of servers as a primary sampling tool?
No, I'm just wondering if you're going to drop the ASCII in favor of the servers.
That has not been determined. So far, we've been doing ASCII along with all of our other sampling, but we have not even gotten to that point where we've talked about what will be happening further on in the project. And we did, along with the Rapid Bioassessment Protocol and the ASCII procedures, there are habitat data forms in which you clearly document the pebble sizes, the types of habitats, percent undercut bank, percent pool, that type of information. and that's how you gather your number of samples from those different habitats. And all of those data are on file, so we do keep track of those types of metrics for each site.
So I guess maybe to Jane, I would suggest that you not drop the ASCII, because you are getting data that you just can't get with a server, and that might be useful information. And since it really looked like statistically they were pretty similar, they were within the error bars, both sites, or both methods, that getting that habitat data might be a useful long-term monitoring a bit of data, and that you not drop ASCII, even though, you know, server's easier. So.
And I want to be clear that in my presentation, I wasn't trying to imply that we plan to drop any of those, either one of those two methods in the future. Just that the server seems to be have a little bit more power in terms of statistical differences over time.
Good, thank you. Any more questions?
Phil Burner, Fish and Wildlife Service. Do you think that the water quality at the mine site influenced macroinvertebrates, like all the metals in the water?
There hasn't been anything done at the proposed mine site yet, so it's hard to say what the maybe you can clarify that a little bit more.
Well, there's a lot of, you know, baseline shows elevated levels of whatever they are, copper, zinc, molybdenum.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even remember what all they are, but
and Mark
especially copper.
Yes. Mark talked yesterday about elements that were naturally elevated above the chronic aquatic life criteria, such as lead and moly and nickel. I suppose that's probably what you're referring to. We see that out there at the project site in most of our samples, not only in the mine site area, but also as I'm getting ready to present in the lake study. The lake is very well mixed, and we are seeing that at a number of different locations in that water body as well. So your question as to do the metals affect the invertebrates, yes, they do. There's quite a body of literature out there that shows that there is a connection there. But I guess I would say that there hasn't been any mining activity that has occurred to date up there. So are they affecting it right now? I don't think so. I think we're truly getting a baseline for that population.
Mm-hmm. I'm Rick Parkin from the Environmental Protection Agency. I was wondering if you identified the other organisms other than those four orders of insects and reported them in the document so we can look those up.
Yes, good question. We did. We identified everything that we could down to genus. As I mentioned, there were a few that we ended up needing to stop at a higher, or I should say lower resolution on. There were others that were identified, and those are reported in the environmental baseline document. If you have a copy of that, you can see a taxa list and some of the other metrics that we presented and discussed in that report. I think there was a slide that I just presented that showed that we found, I believe it was in the server samples, up to 30 taxa in one of our samples, and that's fairly diverse. Any other questions?
Comments, suggestions? Okay, thank you very much, Andrea.